Hello there, and welcome to a brand new episode of the Sports Pro podcast. My name is George Breer. I'm head of content here at Sports Pro. And as ever this week, I'm delighted to be joined by my co-host, Sports Pro's news editor, Tom Basson. Now, Tom, slightly different location for us today. We're under the bright lights.
We are, Lee. We're under the high-tech podcast studio at Sky Sports on their West London campus. And we are lucky enough to be joined by Sky Sports head of women's sports, Joe Osborne. Joe, welcome to the Sports Pro podcast.
Thanks for having me. I haven't been in this room before either, so it's exciting all round.
Normally, Tom and I are told that we have a face for radio, so it's a bit disconcerting to be on the
camera.
I can
see myself way too much right now.
So, Joe, we are talking to you just a week or two ahead of the new WSL season. We can see the logos and our backdrop. What's the excitement levels like here at Sky?
I imagine it's the same with us as it is for all of you. They are super high. Getting to come into another WSL season off the back of another incredible performance from the Lionesses on the world stage, it's a privilege, really. We're excited to be able to build on that superstardom that the Lionesses are building and to build up habit back into the WSL, because I think we all know we've got an amazing property. We just want to keep growing.
And this year marks the third and final year of the recently signed broadcast contract between yourselves and the BBC. As you say, it's about cementing those habits and really cementing the processes that have been put in place through those 3 years. So what does that look like?
I think for us, the first thing is it looks like continued investment. So every single year, on top of the commercial investment we've made in the league, it's about investing in time, in resources. We believe we've got a world-class team working across it. So this year, the headlines are 35 games across Sky Sports. Our first game, 1st of October, Champions Chelsea against London rivals Tottenham. So that's 5:30 on the 1st of October. So we've got, as you say, not long to go. I think what we try and do with all of our properties is to continue to build on what we've already got. But I think it's even more exciting, and I'm sure we'll come onto it more down the line with different properties, with women's sport, because we know that we've got not just a growth opportunity, but an opportunity to do something distinctive, to talk to new fan bases, especially off the back of the Lionesses, and to reach those different touch points for those new audiences that are coming in, because we've got our core audience and it comes a lot from men's football because that's your established traditional product. And then beyond that, we've got all these new, sometimes younger, sometimes more female audiences coming in from these big events. And we know that we can attract them in different ways. So we've got our sports news coverage. We can promote when the games are on all of our digital platforms. But we've also got bespoke social channels. And again, I'm sure we'll come on to sort of mainstreaming versus bespoke at some point. But we've got our bespoke social channels on TikTok and on X. So we know that we can talk to different audiences in different ways. And I think I get very excited thinking about all those younger girls, perhaps, that are coming in through the Lionesses who are going to be new to our platforms and to our content, and we get to experience that with them and be part of their fandom. That's a privilege, I think.
Just so I can take a little step back. So you mentioned Sky Showcase. I feel like I used to have quite a good handle on where all the WSL games are being, like where I could watch them, basically. Like, yeah. I could go to FA Player, some game would be on the BBC, and then you'd have like the sort of marquee games would be on Sky. How is that working for this season then? Is it still kind of that split? Is FA Player still in the mix at all? Like, what's the relationship there? I know you said reach is really important. I guess the more places you can show it, the more reach you get.
That's exactly right. So we have 35 games and we make sure that with those games we reach as far as we can. The BBC will still have some games as well. So that hasn't changed from the last 2 years of the deal. I think what's lovely about our relationship with a lot of our women's sports rights holders, and the FA are no different, is that we talk with them about how to grow that reach. So a lot of what you get on FA Player, you can also see on our on-demand platform. We do a lot of storytelling through, it's called the brand name of it, is Inside the WSL. It's going to live mostly on YouTube this season. So essentially talking about the stories that come behind women's sport. We all know about white shorts into blue shorts. We all know about all those kind of wider stories around kit and ACLs and everything that is really important to how the game grows. We try and tell those stories on the platforms where they resonate the most. So yes, in terms of finding your live content, we try and make sure that's available across Sky Sports, Sky Showcase, and now. And then there will be games on the BBC, and then everything else will live where it's lived. But I think what we try and focus on is signposting to those games, because you've raised a point that comes up a lot around women's sport. How can I find it? Where can I watch it? How do I know what platform it's on? So we do a lot of signposting through sports news and our digital channels, and we don't take for granted that everyone knows what time the game's on, or even what team their favourite Lioness plays for. So there's a lot of storytelling that we want to be doing this season.
You talked about the various different platforms and locations that people can engage with women's sports, whether that's original content, live content, whatever it might be. How important is partnership with those other platforms like the FA when it comes to FA Player or the BBC to say, essentially, rising tides lift all boats, and let's signpost to each other and get longer term engagement and regular and habitual engagement, which will in the long run convert into regular match watching WSL fans?
My favourite thing about working in women's sport is that we find ways to kind of break down a lot of those traditional barriers. I mean, essentially, at the end of the day, we have our rights, the BBC will have theirs, the FA will retain theirs. So that doesn't really change. But actually, in terms of storytelling across all those platforms, then we try and make sure that we're not ignoring storylines that have happened on other games, on other platforms, because we're trying to bring fans to the game as a whole. So it is really important. The FA have been great partners. The clubs are great partners. And actually even talking to the players about what they want. One of the things we're proudest of around our women's sport coverage is the way that we innovate, but innovate in a way that makes women's sport distinctive. So how can we get more access to dressing rooms so that people understand who the players are, so they might be more likely to follow the game? How can we talk about miking up the refs? All those conversations that we have because of those partnerships. And all that does, as you say, rising tide, lifting all boats, all that does is elevate the game to another level where we don't feel like we are at any risk of shrinking and pinking or lifting and shifting from men's sport, because we all know that the game's beyond that now.
When you referenced some of the storylines, it was interesting to hear you say that, you know, some people don't know the club that their favourite lioness plays for. It feels almost impossible when you're talking about the growth of women's sports, particularly women's football, for that not to be tied to the lionesses' success over the past 2 years. And we've seen incredible figures, you know, 100% plus increase in viewership for women's sports as a whole, year on year. I saw that the Women's Sports Trust released some, I think, data yesterday or today, saying that that number's grown even further for 2023. And clearly bumped by the major tournaments that we've seen, the success that we've seen for the England team in particular. It feels almost as if the gauntlet's been thrown down to say, you know, we've had these tentpole moments, we've had these massive surges in interest. How do you capitalise on that to make it something that is longer term and that is more meaningful engagement than it is, you know, essentially just the crest of the wave?
$1 billion question. I think I'd be on my own private island if I had the answer to that one. So if you've got it, that'd be great. Now, I mean, that's what we talk about all the time. You took the words out of my mouth. WSL on Sky Sports was up 45% last season from the season before, and it's four times bigger than it was two seasons ago. So it's big growth. There's two bits to it, really. It's important to understand that we have to turn that into habit, as you say. And that is the question we ask ourselves all the time about how to grow it. To take your sort of points in turn, I think, A, we need to recognise all the work that's gone in before we started investing in the WSL, and we're really proud of that investment. And, you know, as I say, we continue to do it through the season. But actually, there's a lot of work that's gone in from people working in women's football, the communities around it, the players themselves, to get it to the point where it is at this amazing moment. And then success on the world stage really helps. I think for us, storytelling is, and we talk about it all the time, don't we? I'm sure people come up on this podcast all the time and talk about storytelling. What does it mean? But actually thinking about what those different audiences might want. So is it more stats-based content? Do they just need to know where the game's on? Is it results? Do they want to know more about the lifestyles of certain players? Do they want more moments rather than highlights? How long do they want those highlights to be? How often are they watching? Are they watching live? Are they catching up? There's so much to learn about this growing audience that I think we're not taking that job lightly, and organisations like the Women's Sport Trust help massively because that research really helps us sort of to pin those things, two things down. The other thing I think that's interesting about it is that there is an element to how people are consuming Women's Super League and women's sport in general that is quite interesting as a template for the modern fan. So women's sports fans are the fastest growing fan base. They're more likely to be digital savvy because they've had to work harder to find their content for a really long time until quite recently. They're more likely to be content creators. They're values driven, and they're more likely to be spending their money with brands that they really agree with the purpose of. And you see that coming through in Premier League as well now with those younger fans, male and female. So I think this idea that it's just about forming habit is interesting. I think what's also interesting is if you can capture that fan either through women's sport or otherwise, you've got yourself a much longer term engagement with a really, really exciting new kind of fan. It's a roundabout way of answering your question, but I think we look at building habit, we look at bringing people to the live first and foremost, but we also think about what different types of content our different fan bases might want to consume and what platforms they might want to consume them on.
Does that mean you have to look differently at like what counts as a win? We got X amount of viewers onto this game, but actually we got this many views or this much engagement on our social platforms around this thing. And that's actually maybe as good as that. I guess the only question is when that comes back to, I don't know, selling to a brand or a partner, like how do you explain that they're the same or they're equal or at least kind of in the same ballpark?
I think we do need to look at the metrics we use to measure success. I think that's exactly right. As you mentioned from those stats, the growth is there. The viewing numbers are growing. Our more traditional metrics are there. But the value piece on what it means to someone if a brand has women's sport, what it means that a brand dedicates time, energy, resources, cold hard cash to women's sport, I think is something that we are, all brands are starting to factor in. And that is an exciting, especially that younger, more female audience is a really exciting audience for a lot of brands. So it's very nice when the right thing to do coincides with a commercial opportunity, but not just that, but becomes a commercial opportunity. So when you're doing something because it's the right thing to do, it's somehow performative, you're somehow box ticking. When you're doing it because it's a commercial opportunity, you do start digging into those exciting numbers. And then you do start giving it that parity and that resource and time that allows it to kind of really blossom. So yeah, I think again, lots of different brands will be thinking about how they measure what success looked like with different campaigns. And I think around the World Cup, the Women's Sport Trust research showed us that there were lots of personal health and beauty brands investing in that tournament. And that was the highest category. I don't think we'd have said that about sport before. So there's a massive opportunity opened up via women's football for brands to actually reach their audience.
I think there's so much to unpick from that. And I feel that every time that pieces of research like the Women's Sports Trust come out, a lot of the focus becomes is directed towards the top line numbers, you know, the percentage in viewing time increase or the number of people that are watching. But as you say, it's the demographic is just as interesting. And this is not, you know, capturing from the same audience pool that men's sport is seeing. Actually, in many cases, it's a totally different audience segment. So when you're looking at those metrics and you're looking at particularly, you know, Sky Sports audience, how much of it is a learning journey, essentially, to say this is a completely new fan base that we're engaging with, in many cases for the first time. So understanding what they want, where they want it, how they want it, which brands they want to identify with and what they find purpose-driven is actually something we're having to learn for the first time because there isn't a template here from men's sport.
Yeah, I love how you've just put that. I don't think there is a template. That's daunting and exciting at the same time. But yeah, that's exactly what we do. And innovation is a key part of our women's sports strategy. I say it as if it is a whole strategy, but it very much breaks down into our different sports because they aren't all the same. It's a key part of it because testing and learning will allow us to reach those audiences in a different way. We have a huge heritage in sport, obviously. It's losing the name. But actually, so we can bring that and we can bring those production values and we can bring that amazing talent and we can bring all those teams that have been working on this sport for such a long time. And we have incredible people working in this building across all of our sport, including our women's sport. But actually, the chance to test and learn, not because it's less important, we don't care what happens with it, exactly the opposite, because there's this big opportunity for it to be growing and different. And, you know, the Premier League is seen as the pinnacle of lots of sport and, you know, in terms of making money and in terms of commercial proposition and fan base across the world. And there's so much of it that is that. But actually, have we got the opportunity to forge a slightly different path? It could be as big as, but it could be different. So it's parity without replicating. And I think that's at the heart of everything we try and do.
Because one thing I find so fascinating about the women's sports landscape is it seems almost every major stakeholder refers to it as a startup or within startup-like language. I mean, you yourself just using words like testing and different user bases, etc. How difficult is that to balance when you're talking about, you know, multi-million pound investments for brands in some cases, for Sky in many cases, but making these investments without having those clear, you know, ROI use cases behind you? And how difficult is that as an internal conversation? How difficult is that, you know, to justify, etc.?
I think it's a really interesting one. We're really lucky. I think the fact that my job exists, the fact that our teams exist, show that Sky Sports is serious about women's sport as an investment. But the lack of roadmap means that we have more challenging, well, we have challenging conversations around everything because we care about what we come out with. But we have very challenging conversations around what the right thing to do is. And sometimes you end up with a strategy that sort of says, do both. i.e. talk to our core audience, find this new audience, find the platforms, keep trying. It's not the easiest thing to sell. Do both. It doesn't feel very clear, but it is actually really clear and it's very audience driven. So I would say, yes, the lack of roadmap makes it challenging. We are very lucky that we have the backing of the business and we've been investing in women's sport for over 25 years. So it's a long-term investment piece for us. What changes is how we make the best out of that investment. Every single year, every single month, we're looking at how we're getting the right return across those different metrics of value that we just talked about.
Could you give us an example of how you do both?
Yeah, let's talk about the WSL. So we know that there is a huge opportunity with an inherited audience that we get from our Super Sunday coverage into that 6:45 p.m. Sunday kickoff. So we know that there is a massive opportunity to cross promote from that much bigger product, much more established product, into a growing product, the WSL. So I would say that would be mainstreaming WSL to our core audience on our linear channels. But by making sure that we're maximizing the promotion across Now, which we do a lot on our digital platforms, we are talking to a Sky audience that perhaps is more female or more used to coming for different sports. And then if you've seen our sort of WSL TikTok channel offering, it is very targeted at the younger female audience. But also we know that we can be not just using different formats, asking different questions, sort of less reverent with the product so that we can talk to them in a way that engages them. And actually the numbers that we see on that platform are much more female than we see on our linear platform. So that's a more platform specific way of doing both. But I think also we are very focused across all of our coverage, including women's sport, of making that product, and it is a product, more accessible to a wider group of people. So we are bringing in talent who we think appeal to the biggest demographic because our opportunity is so wide.
I know that like Sky in Germany do, they've done like vertical broadcast and done that onto, I think they did it on TikTok and probably about a couple of other places as well. Would you consider doing something like that with the WSL using that, like as you said, that like different talent to anchor it?
Vertical broadcast is really interesting. And actually Burnley did a really good one a couple of seasons ago as well with their women's team. We are always looking at new formats. And I think we're also looking at something I think about a lot and our teams think about a lot is, what do we mean by the boxes that we put talent in? So what does a presenter mean? What does a reporter mean? What does the commentator mean? And actually, where do we want to break the traditional rules of sport? So yes, it's always something we're looking at. And in our partnerships, it's always something we're talking about. How can we innovate? So we'll have another WSL innovation game this season. And we're always looking to sort of push the boundaries on what we do and test it out, just like we did with Premier League juniors and F1 juniors this year, talking to a younger audience. And that all comes about through those strong relationships with the governing bodies. So yeah, it's always a conversation.
For those people who don't know, and like we've got listeners like in the US and stuff, what is the WSL Innovation Game?
Oh, yes, sorry. We do them across all of our different football properties. So there's an EFL Innovation Game, it's a Premier League Innovation Game. And essentially, it's a chance for us to test out things that we think are going to be exciting in the future with the various clubs and with the various organisations. So it could be marking up refs on the pitch. It could be dressing room cameras. It could be, you know, walk and talks in the middle of the pitch at halftime. It could be things that we don't normally get to do to try and show where the game is going, different camera, one angle, so that main angle of coverage. So essentially it's a partnership to try and test out new ideas so that we see where we might want to go in the future.
Are there any in the roadmap for this season and what's coming down the pipeline?
We're still talking a lot about how to get closer to the players and how to get closer to the action. What we don't want to do, if we're talking about women's sports specifically, is to ask more of female athletes than we would do in terms of actual volume than we would do of their male counterparts. Just because it's up and coming and is a growth opportunity doesn't mean they should have to work twice as hard whilst also trying to focus on being elite athletes. So we're trying to work out where we take those wins. So yes, we are looking at how we get closer in terms of microphone access, in terms of dressing room access, in terms of interviews, to make sure that we can keep telling the stories of those players to this new fan base. So yes, watch this space, I would say.
As I mentioned at the top of the show, this season is the final one in the current broadcast cycle. You've talked about investment into the women's game, what that looks like. So I'm keen to hear your thoughts ahead of the right cycle and looking at Sky's plans there. And particularly when it comes to that investment, what the balance is between a longer term investment and the security that that brings with it, but then also the very fast change in which the commercials are taking place. And we're seeing growth at, you know, unprecedented levels. And with that comes a very different outlook to what maybe was purchased 3 years ago. So what's the balance there between looking at that longer term investment where you can have the creativity to do these innovations and really lay out that security with the financial dynamism?
As you're probably going to be aware that I'm going to say, I can't comment directly on any upcoming rights processes, but I
love the but.
Hopefully it's going to be enough. But we talked about innovation. I think innovative partnerships are one of the ways that we really look to kind of make women's sport sing for us. So we're always looking at how we can do things that are different from that traditional model.
And when you talk about that investment, how much integration or involvement do Sky have in where that investment's going? So yes, there have been some really fantastic numbers that we're seeing in terms of overall growth, interest, commercial involvement in particular. But I know Karen Carney's report that came out recently suggested that women's football in particular might not be built on the strongest of foundations. So I think the phrase she used that it was built on sand, and that, you know, there's serious commercial jeopardy underneath the elite level. So how much concern is there from someone like Sky that's investing in an elite product to make sure that, yes, the pathway still exists for others to come through, and that there is a property that essentially is set for decades to come?
I think when we invest, you know, in good faith into a product that we, you know, we do our due diligence, we know that we're investing into something we believe in. But I think with every growth sport, there always has to be a focus on what's coming next. And with every partner that we work in, we trust that they will have that investment. I think a really good example is ECB with the 100 and everything they're doing around that. We partner with them to build it because we know that it's going to bring in the next generation. And we've seen, you know, benefits. The women's game in particular has seen benefits through it. So we have a great history of investing in a way that we hope will grow a game. And that is you've mentioned it before with the rising tide. Everyone's goal is the same: grow the game, grow it from elite level to grassroots level. Because we've got grassroots level, you've got the pyramid, you've got the pipelines that bring you the next elite level. It's the magic that everyone's looking for. We all want the same thing, and you have to hope that everyone's going into it with the same goals.
I think it was a WSL media day today, and Dawn Airey was there. Something she said before about how she wants the WSL in 10 years' time to be a $1 billion property, right? We all know in this room that a sports property doesn't get to be a $1 billion property without there being a very, very significant amount of money being paid for media rights. Do you think that, like, on just the media side alone, you can take off your Sky Sports hat if you want, but just, like, objectively, is that realistic that in 10 years' time, a broadcaster will be paying for the rights at that level, that it would be a $1 billion property?
Well, I don't know if she was saying it was going to be a $1 billion industry just from media rights, but I could have got...
No, but I mean, like, to, like... No, so I mean, something more like... So, like, I don't know, a significant proportion of that $1 billion is going to be coming from media, right?
I mean, it's the poison chalice, in a way, of being a broadcaster, is you grow something, it's worth more the next time. I mean, that's what we do in everything. We're in a rights rental cycle, so that's where we are. So I think everything that we invest in, you've got to be hoping that it grows and therefore gets to that point. It's kind of the same point. I don't think anybody doubts the opportunity we've got, the direction it goes in, England's performances on the global stage, the talent we can attract in, all of those things will have an impact. But the fact that there are several independent reports that are putting that value up there is really encouraging to see. But yeah, I mean, it's good and it's bad for us, because we have to pay more the next time, so you never know.
Well, yeah, I mean, also, I guess it kind of, like, if it gets to being that level, does that mean that you wouldn't be able to spend on other things? Or is it like, you, if it's being that successful, then it's also good for you? You're able to cash in on that in the same way?
I mean, everything will come. There's not an endless pot for everything, right? There's a knock-on impact with everything that we do. I think the first hurdle, I'm more focused on the first hurdle, which is we have to make women's sport, WSL, all women's sport, as commercially viable as possible. That means bringing subscribers to it. That means making sure that it's part of our sort of key value metrics. Our first goal is to bring more subscribers to Sky Sports through women's sport. And then we go from there onto the next stage. So I think it's, as you said right at the beginning, it's an ecosystem. There are plenty of points that have to work out, from sponsorship to attendance to governance to media rights to all sorts of things, to elite performance, that will get us to that point. But we feel very much part of it, and very much we want to be part of the growth of this game that we see as being such an opportunity.
I guess Tom's question presupposes that, like the men's game, the women's game will be commercially built on media rights as the primary driver. And do you agree with that? Do you still see media rights as being the financial engine for women's sports in the same way that it is with the men's?
It's the that roadmap, isn't it? You've got that sort of sliding doors effect of things going in so many different directions. And it, again, if I had the answer, I would be running away to Barbados. But I think short term, we feel like we're a big part of growing the women's sports that we're involved with, and we want to remain a big part of that. I think what will probably change from my point of view is that you will have an opportunity to take what's worked about those big men's sports rights and add in new opportunities, like whole new categories of media sponsorship, like perhaps an untapped, I mean, we won't have time to dig into this in much detail, and this, we don't have a lot of information about it yet, but an untapped group of people in the older women that we don't perhaps talk to as much across sponsorship and brands, in terms of they're coming back into sport and they're watching more sport with their families. What, you know, there's whole new categories there that I think will add revenue and will add value to women's sport. But we still certainly see ourselves as key to that growth at the moment.
Looking at the short term piece that you talked about, essentially how you can use the WSL and your women's sports properties to drive subscribers to Sky. One of the topics that we've debated on this podcast a lot is whether or not women's sports needs to go behind the paywall and the increased commercial viability that that brings, essentially the reach versus revenue conundrum. So we've seen, for instance, in Europe, DAZN taking the decision to move their women's football portfolio back behind the paywall, having had that free to air for the last couple of years. What's the balance there in your view from Sky's point of view?
I think this is the benefit of being able to spend more time and energy thinking about the commercial proposition of women's sport, is that we need to be specific. So every women's sport is on a different stage of its journey. So you've got the WSL there, which currently we believe to be, and I can't see this changing, but different platforms will have different views on it. It has value for us. We are investing in it because it has value for us, and therefore it's sitting on our key platforms. It goes on Main Event wherever it can. It's on Showcase, which is right up the EPG. That's a demonstration of its value, as well as of us wanting to reach the most people. But I think we look at different sports that we work with at a different stage of their evolution and their journey and their commercial journey and their fandom journey. And we see the benefit of working with them to make sure we reach more people. So we'll put live games on YouTube with England Netball, for example. We will, and the same with the 100 for the Women's 100. Those will sit on YouTube because we know, and Sky Sports Mix, which is open, also open to the Sky's base. So we know that that will reach more people as it grows. And I think what we have to do with all of these properties is take a read at every point and say, where is it in its commercial kind of, where is it on that J curve, and where is it going to sit next year? And how do we want to maximize our investment, but also make sure that we're thinking long term about that investment.
One final thing on that. Does that become a transition? So instead of moving, you know, directly, it's all binary A or B, Sky Sports paywall or not, is there a sort of, I guess, a phased approach where you begin to move some games behind the Sky Sports paywall and some remain either free to air via platforms like YouTube or through the things like Sky Sports Mix that are open just to the Sky subscriber base?
I think we take every case as it comes. And as you've said, we're in the final year of a current deal. Who knows what any new deal might bring? So I think we have to make sure that we are. The great thing about working here and having these platforms available to us is we do have a real range. We can make those decisions and we can look at what works best where. And we know in every calendar, in every domestic league, there are tentpole games that get elevated across more platforms. We have games that we're getting in extra to make available to more people. Each of those games, it's actually genuinely each game we look at independently and say, where does this best live? What do we want to do with it? How do we want to promote it? Which interview we're going to do on Sky Sports News to really make the most of this. It is that level of detail to make sure that we are maximizing viewing for every single game. So yeah, so specific. We're game by game basis.
It's probably a good point to open it up into like some of the other women's sports properties. I know we've kind of touched on them quite a lot, but I know George, you wanted to talk about the 100. I mean, I don't know if you've listened to the podcast before. We can't stop him talking about cricket. It's often a bit of a problem. But like the 100s, like for me, it's an interesting competition in that, like, I think the perception maybe and unfairly is that like the women's tournament is much more successful than the men's tournament in terms of like maybe not in viewership figures, but just in terms of like cut through and achieving the goals that the ECB wanted to set out for it. Is that, do you think, like that perception fair or not as a result of like the way that it's been like elevated by Sky and by the BBC in conjunction?
You can't take the results without taking the context of what people expected. It's expectation versus reality, isn't it? Not quite in the sort of Insta versus reality mold, but you know, you've got where the women's game was coming from to where the men's game was coming from. And I think that gives us the context. So the way that I kind of see it is, would we ever have said a couple of years ago that the men's game of any format needed the women's game? Probably not, but actually it does need that women's game to give it what is special about it. Those double headers are brilliant. They're bringing in a more family audience. It's helped them hit more of their targets. And actually, we've seen since the 100, the WPL's come in and we're having record-breaking numbers being spent on female cricketers. They've got an incredible level of global talent across the women's 100. And as you say, the numbers have been strong. So I think you just have to take it against the context. And then obviously since then, you know, there are more changes coming in women's cricket. What's not to flip it to the Ashes immediately, but I think what's been really exciting this summer is to see the Ashes running into the 100, running into that Sri Lanka series for women's cricket, for England women, and seeing that habit continue and be built off the back of an international stage. And for me, there is a massive opportunity still in bringing that men's cricket audience over to women's cricket. And I think the 100's done that really, really well.
Do you think there's also a slight sense that the women's game has been a breath of fresh air into the cricket landscape? It's brought new audiences to the game that it seems from the outside anyway that have been really invested in that format. And it's fair to say, and probably trying to be quite diplomatic, but the men's game has an audience that's less willing to embrace change and new formats. I think some of the viewing figures that more people watch just the women's 100 than they did both formats. And so actually we're talking about essentially two different audiences here. One have really embraced the product and it was built for them. This is a product that was entirely built for that audience. And actually the men's format, there's an audience that's just very reticent to embrace the change that's come. So I think, Tom, when you say that whether it's fair or not that the women's 100 is seen as more successful, if you look at the pure goals of the 100's creation, it has objectively been more successful in bringing those new audiences and bringing new people to the game.
And I think when you say the men's game has been less likely to accept it, actually the traditional game is the men's game. I think that's kind of what we're conflating, isn't it? And actually, you know, cricket is the most historically, unapologetically male game I can think of, historically. Mm. So actually this idea that those audiences might be less willing was always part of that journey for the ECB, I think. And then we obviously worked with them on that format. But actually, I think what you've touched on is something wider about women's sport. And actually, I might throw it back to you both, is that, so what do you love about women's cricket that's different? Because I think everybody has something about women's sport that they see as distinctive and different.
It's a good question. I'm a bit of a cricket addict, as Tom's alluded to. So I've been to plenty of games, always as part of the double headers. I think that women's sport in general, from what I've experienced, is a far more welcoming atmosphere. So if I was to go with a group of friends who, you know, I wanted to enjoy a nice day out, I would almost certainly choose to go to a women's game over a men's game, just because I think the atmosphere is more welcoming. It's more wholesome, I guess, is one way of putting it. I also think that the level of play in the women's 100 is extraordinarily high, and it's very different. If you're looking for the same sport, you're going to leave disappointed. I remember one example from a sportswear conference that really stuck with me was Coley Edison from the WNBA talking about the broadcasting of a WNBA fixture. And one of the broadcasters saying, you know, we set up these like 8 or 9 dunk cams. And she was saying, well, why are you doing that? Because there's only been X number of dunks in the WNBA ever. And I think that highlights one of the things I like about the Women's 100. It's the tactical nuances are different. The complexities are different. And sometimes you are watching a different sport. I enjoy that. I enjoy the differences that that brings. And I think it's a really, particularly when it's contrasted with the men's just after, it's a really enjoyable day of, you know, seeing the whole cricketing ecosystem, I guess, at once.
So I think it comes back to your point about metrics, right? If you take the same metrics for men's and women's cricket, you come out with something that looks like a less valuable game. But if you're looking at catch speed or if you're looking at, you know, bowling variances, you're going to get a little bit more to the point of what people enjoy. Sorry, I'm going to let you answer.
Well, like, it's kind of similar to what you're just saying. Like, if you watch the two things side by side and you're like, oh, and you're used to watching one, right? Like, I've watched men's cricket all my life. I've watched men's football all my life. And then you watch the women's one. And I actually had this argument in a pub recently with my friends. It's like, don't compare them. They're not the same thing. You don't complain watching the women's 100 meter final that she's not as running as fast as Usain Bolt, because like that's just not going to happen. Like, you can't compare like apples and oranges. It doesn't work like that. And actually, if you start enjoying the things that are different, then that's actually like, that's where it comes from. That's where that level of enjoyment comes from. You're like, all right, yeah. So they've actually got to do this thing differently. And like, there's real skill in that. And that doesn't exist in the men's game, and that doesn't exist in the women's game. And you can enjoy those both separately, I think. And it is probably like a bit of an education thing. It's like identifying what those things are and enjoying those nuances.
Can I add one more thing there? Sorry, I don't want to cover all the bases here, but one thing before we came on air, we were actually chatting about new sports, and I've tried to like embrace the NFL this year because I feel working in sport and reading about sport all day and talking about sport all day, I don't know the right way of saying it, but it can get a bit, you know, same. And one of the things I love about women's sports is it's new characters, it's new personalities, it's new storylines. And in the Women's 100, you have these incredibly talented young people who are breaking through now in the last 18 months. You know, you look at someone like Alice Capsey, for instance, cricket, Lauren Bell. I mean, these players that are so young but have done so much already in the game. And then you contrast that with someone like a Nat Siverbrunt, who's, you know, been through that transition and has this amazing record and is going for this incredible money in the WPL. And it really feels as if you are on a journey with a property that's on a really exciting trajectory, and the characters are exciting, the storylines are exciting, and, you know, all the different acts of the story, whether it's the WPL in India, or, you know, it is the 100, or it is the Ashes, it's new. And I think that's something to really be, I love that side of it.
To flip that around a little bit, how do you then as a broadcaster do that education piece, or try and find that like that story to tell in order to kind of convince, I don't know, the people that I'm arguing with in a pub, in order to engage with it in the way that I'm trying to get them to?
Keep arguing for a start.
I will.
We need more. I think you've just touched on it for me. It's about bringing up about the personalities, and I loved both of your reasons for loving women's sport. And I think those are two that we hear a lot. The other one, I think I can probably relate to more as a woman, is that it's watching women play sport. Like, bottom line, as a woman, it's watching women playing elite sport. They are being celebrated for it and they are brilliant at it. And there is a lot to be said for just pure human, relatable. And I think women's sport brings out a lot of that sort of, yes, I say relatable, they're elite athletes, but there is something really human and relatable. There is a joy, there is a passion. But I think to answer your question better, what we do is we try and explain the history, because I think women's sport's got its own history and this exciting future. So what we did during the Ashes was show a series about the history of women's cricket, which a lot of people don't know about, just how recently ago, you know, they had to wear skirts to play, or they were in corsets. So, I mean, it's pretty crazy, but they also get to know names like Rachel Hayhoe Flint, like Claire Connor, like Charlotte Edwards. So people that have grown the game to where it is, but also give it that context. So then you can take on those fresh faces, you can watch the Izzy Wongs of the world and get excited by what's to come for it. So I think it's about giving the context without taking the fun out of it. And there's sort of different elements to that storytelling. But I think essentially you fall in love with a player, you fall in love with their story, you're more likely to go and want to watch them do what they do and do brilliantly. So that's a big part of what we try and do.
Guess that's why we do all we do as well. We've been captivated by those stories since we were small.
I'd like to ask about golf, if that's okay.
Yeah, good time to talk about golf.
So like, obviously we've got the Solheim coming up this week. I was lucky enough to go to the Open this year in Surrey, which is really cool. And like, for me, like, going back to that like relatable thing, actually women's golf is way more relatable for me, because like they actually kind of, if I'm striking the ball well, and like this happens like one time out of 100, I can maybe hit it as far. Yeah. So, and that feels way more relatable than watching Rory McIlroy spank a 400-yard drive. Not attainable to me in any way whatsoever. I'm going to challenge you a little bit on this. I get a little bit frustrated when I try and watch LPGA on Sky, because I can't find it. It might be on YouTube, but I don't know it's there. And like, I've actually been watching like, I don't know, early rounds of a major, and then it cuts away and it cuts to a PGA Tour event, and it's like a run-of-the-mill PGA Tour event. I'm like, why are you cutting away from a major to go and watch this run-of-the-mill PGA Tour event? And like, it's something I've actually wanted to ask someone at Sky for ages, so I'm glad I'm getting a chance to do this on the podcast.
Well, you've hit on one of the most challenging parts of women's sport, is that we are trying to build new engagement and new fandom when the schedule is often against us. And it's a conversation that we have really openly with the LPGA and the LET, and continue to do so, about how we will look to schedule in the future to make sure that it doesn't happen as much. It's one of the challenges about having one golf channel. What we do to offset it is exactly as you've just referenced, is to put as much of it on YouTube as possible. So A, lots of people can see it, but then it's got its own space, as well as putting it on the red button so it's viewable, it's to everybody. But yeah, it's just one of the biggest challenges we face in women's sport is scheduling. It comes up in every piece of research, it comes up in lots of our conversations, and we are dealing with very packed schedules. And we'll hear it a lot, won't we, as WSL, EFL, Premier League, that 3 p.m. slot, all the talk that goes around that, right? That everyone's fighting for that valuable space. I think as the sports grow, and you mentioned the Solheim Cup, which should be really, I mean, you know, three in a row would be amazing. There's some incredible storylines. There's some incredible players going to be in Spain this weekend. So I think as those storylines grow, we will see that those tournaments get more space. What I'm really proud of that we do is we do give them that front channel access as much as possible. And it is there when actually there's always going to be men's golf on at the same time. And actually it's on the front channel and it gets that space to shine as much as we can. Like we talked about with those WSL games, it's a constant and daily and hourly conversation about when storylines change. And perhaps one of those vagaries of working with linear scheduling where sometimes a storyline can change in half an hour. So that run-of-the-mill event becomes, you know, very, very exciting, or vice versa. And you have to make last-minute changes to try and accommodate. So yeah, it's a challenge that I wish we could solve single-handedly, but we will continue to play our part in solving it.
With Solheim, does that give you a chance to like elevate the profile of those people? Because like, it's a much bigger event in terms of eyeballs on. People love golf team events. They capture a lot more people than a general standard week-to-week LPGA or LE Tour event. How do you take advantage of that? Is it kind of similar thing, as you said, with the Lionesses and the World Cup?
Yeah, actually, I'd say it's more similar to the Ashes because of the scheduling this year is unique. I think will never happen again, having back-to-back Solheim and Ryder Cups. So because of, obviously, the knock-on from COVID, we have another Solheim Cup next year to build towards as well. So it's about how can we cross-promote from the much bigger, more established brand of the Ryder Cup to the Solheim Cup. How can we, as you say, sort of almost pre-promote, because one is before the other, to make sure we get as many people that are going to be tuning into the Ryder Cup to be tuning in for the Solheim Cup? And how can we tell those stories ahead of the event? There's also some really interesting tech that's going to be going on around the Solheim this weekend. We're bringing some really cool visuals to it, so, and a really great team. So that idea of it looking and feeling very similar, but bringing out what's distinctively different, will continue through that coverage. So we're really excited, and hopefully we'll make some history as well.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to being hungover on Sunday.
Excellent.
Why is that? I think you described it as a once-in-a-lifetime. Obviously, not to take it back to cricket too soon. I can see Tom rolling his eyes already. but it did feel a great decision from the ECB to essentially co-program the Ashes. So it became a... both the women's and the men's Ashes became a synonymous Ashes series. And I'll consume cricket content if it's the last thing on this planet. But, you know, I enjoyed the sort of day on, day off, essentially, between the men's and the women's. I mean, some of the stats saw like massive increase in engagement. Like the women's test match, I think, saw four times as many people tune in as 2019.
Yeah.
And it really worked. I think it did obviously help that both series were nail-bitingly close the whole way through. So why don't more sports take that approach and try to co-program in the same way?
It's a really interesting question. And yeah, the stats were great. And I think it was the highest ever peak we ever saw for an international women's 2020 as well. I mean, across from the test to the ODIs to the 2020s, we saw records broken, which was incredible. And again, I think the attendances were right up there as well. But I think it comes back to that idea of being specific. So where does it work to co-pro? And I think the Ashes saw benefit from that. We had a joint campaign as well with Buer and Glen Batting, so we made sure that we were bringing those audiences together. Ashes is a great example. Solheim and Ryder Cups are a great example. Whereas I think we see with Premier League and WSL, we see the chances to bring them together and the chances to make them stand alone. And that's what we do across all of our kind of content. I think you'll see with Formula One and Formula One Academy next year that they'll start to grow that proposition. And that's very much bringing that smaller brand up through the bigger brand. And we know exactly where they are on that journey. So I think the ECB nailed it. And we just have to make sure that we are looking for those opportunities to do it wherever it works. But I just don't think it's the same in every single category.
Yeah, because one thing I find interesting is a lot of the conversation around women's sports audiences are people that, I think there was 40% of women's Ashes watchers had never engaged with women's sports before, was I think the stat that Sky released, which is a huge cross-pollination, I guess, from the two audience bases. So when you can get both working in tandem, right, like bringing new audiences that haven't been engaged with sport in the past, and then these massive fan bases and massive audiences from men's sports that can translate into the women's game, you combine those two, it's a pretty powerful audience base, right, for broadcasters, for partners, etc.
Absolutely. I mean, if you think of it as Venn diagrams, you've got this big group of people that come to men's sport, you've got perhaps a smaller group of people that come to women's sport. What you want is the biggest group in the middle. You want the biggest group coming to both. But if we can grow that right-hand sliver as well and bring as many new audiences in as possible, and we touched on it at the beginning about this idea of the sort of modern fan and what women's sport fans bring us, they do bring in new audiences. They are a great way to speak to younger audiences and more female audiences, because some of them are finding sport for the first time because of that atmosphere you talked about, because of it being a more welcoming place to perhaps bring children or go with their friends. There's big groups. It's like someone described it to me recently as a girl gang you want to be a part of, women's sport, which I think is really nice, because it's that group, there's groups of young women coming to WSL games. I think we're sort of smashing through those stereotypes of it's dads and daughters, or it's, which it is, but it's not all, or it's, you know, all families and young kids. It's this brilliant spectrum of new fans, and we want to kind of be part of how they grow their fandom.
And when it comes to advertisers, are you seeing a huge shift in the types of brands that are, you know, bidding for advertising slots within women's sports and those that are engaging with women's sports properties compared to the male counterparts?
I think what the Women's Sport Trust research showed us is that there are opportunities being taken to talk directly to those new female fans, not that all fans of women's sport are women by any stretch of the imagination, but that new category of fans. So definitely we're seeing a shift in that. And what's interesting about it even more, and again, I'll refer back to that research, this isn't our research, is that the engagement is even higher with those sort of, so the Il Maquillage brand with Arsenal, plus Leah Williamson with Gucci, those are the ones, so not just about reach, but talk about your metrics, the ones that created more engagement. So not only is there reach coming with some of our women's sports brands, but actually there is a very engaged group that are coming to those deeper activations where it connects with lifestyle and culture and music. And that's, I think, one of the biggest shifts we've seen over the last couple of years. Everything we've talked about is it feels like women's sports hitting the mainstream. You've got Kim Kardashian bringing her sons to an Arsenal game, but dressing them in Arsenal women's shirts. You've got, you know, Beyonce playing at Tottenham Stadium, not technically sport, but, you know, if you get the chance to mention Beyonce, you've got to bring her in. But, you know, they're bringing women into a space they might not have been in before. So there are really clear steps towards women's sport hitting the mainstream. And that will be catnip for brands.
It certainly felt like the last 12 to 18 months have felt like a new step has been taken and, you know, a new floor really has been met. What are you most excited about over the next, you know, we talked about 10 years, billion-dollar business. What are you most excited about in going into that 10-year window?
That's such a great question. I'm excited about loads of it. I think the idea of the stars of women's sport that I watch every day, and I'm, you know, I'm like you both, I'm a massive sports fan. I've been working in this business for 20 years. I came in as a sports fan. The idea that I'm going to see them on billboards, I'm going to be able to talk about. So I think a lot of traditional sports fans come in with 6 WhatsApp groups about the games at the weekend, come in with it hitting every point of their life. I wouldn't say that's true for me. It's very much, you know, a group of people that I have that I love sport with. And then a lot of my friends and family don't really engage in the same way. And I love the idea that it's going to become so mainstream that it's going to start hitting every part of my life and women like me and other people like me. So this idea that we're just moving outside of this bubble we've been put in. I also can't, you know, separate that from women in society, women in the workplace, you know, the idea that we are creating an environment and a society that is better for everyone coming into it, whoever you might be. And I feel like women's sport is a demonstration of where we are societally. So the more we can do in women's sport, the better I feel about the world I live in.
It's quite an interesting point to come into, like, Sky, actually. You said you've been working in women's sport for a long time. You're now head of the girl gang, I think, as the head of women's sport.
Oh, Sky Sports. Best job title ever.
There you go. Like, how has Sky changed and how is Sky changing in that regard? Like, do you see more women working, like, working in sport, and how does that change, like, the content that you produce as well? Because for me, I think it, like, it brings about that diversity of thought, which you don't get if you don't have that.
Totally agree. You took the words out of my mouth. I think, so I've been in Sky for over 20 years. My role is a new one, but it doesn't mean that the focus is a new one, because actually what we've always done is thought very carefully about women's sport to, you know, I think I mentioned it earlier, do we put it in a bubble over there and other it, or do we, so actually, you know, our women's football team works as part of our football team. Our women's golf team is part of our golf team. Those are where the specialisms for those sports sits, because we take them seriously. But actually what we've realized as everything changes is to give something the time and the resource and to connect all those dots and to find those, all those opportunities, we need to also give some specialist time. So the good news is we've not just decided this year that women's sport's important. And I think that's mirrored in the cultural piece is, yes, there are more women across the industry, both working in sport and working in sports media. But the important thing is, are their voices being heard? Have they got a voice in what content we make, in how our culture is built? And I think, you know, as representation builds, and that will be a process, we need to make sure we're doing the other thing, because otherwise it doesn't matter how many people you have around the table because you're not listening to them. So I think this idea that we go beyond representation and what we do on screen is something that we work very hard on off screen to make sure that we are giving people a voice and that those diverse voices have a place in every piece of content that we make. Because actually, at the end of the day, not only is it the right thing to do on every single level, but it's just like women's sport, isn't it? It's an opportunity, because if you're going to bring people into the room and you don't listen to them, then you are missing the opportunity to make content that appeals to more and more people, which essentially just also makes good business sense, doesn't it?
50% of the world.
Yeah. Who knew?
On that, you talked about the scheduling conflicts in golf, yep, for instance. Yep. So how receptive are colleagues within male sport to essentially like sharing that screen time and the programming challenges that come with, you know, massively increasing the schedule and the calendar by the number of sports events? So how receptive is there internally to find creative solutions that might be a little bit more, that might pinch on the male sports, for instance?
I think if you look at the number of hours that Sky Sports broadcast, which is more hours than anybody else this year so far, and the number of viewers that we're bringing to that broadcast, I think the answer's there. We show more than anyone else, and we show more than we've ever shown before. So we're making decisions every day that hero women's sport, that bring it to the forefront. So visibility for me is about prominence as much as visibility. You talk about finding it, right? It's not just about having it there. It's about being able to find it. So the more we can bring it to the top of our channels, the better. So we're making decisions like that every day, and we're committed to diversity within the whole organization, but we're also committed to growing the sports that we take on board. And you know, we have a lot of outlets to do that, and it's always a juggle and a balance, but we wouldn't be doing it if we couldn't give them the airtime. So I think it should show in what you see on screen, and we're really proud of that. Also, we're very lucky to work with a lot of allies who really, you know, I don't know if you saw recently, there was a stunt essentially, but with Jill Scott and Gary Neville around swapping Twitter accounts. Like we're really lucky to have lots of people in the building that want to make sure that everybody has the same voice that they have. So that helps immensely. I think if I look at one example where that's come across the best, perhaps in the last year, and it is almost a year ago now, would be the Boxer Fight Night, the Shields Marshall headlined first ever televised all-female fight night in the UK and Ireland. And if you look at how that event came together, that was basically like our sort of best version of how we can like put a boxing OB together. The night was brilliant. It was different from anything we'd done before. The belts were at the center of it. There were these amazing fights, but we were able to adapt and change so that Clarissa Shields could turn up in a ball gown, and we had a Spice Girl, and Jill Scott was there. And, you know, we were able to kind of hero these incredible up and coming talents. Now that was probably, that's going to take the effort of some of our biggest performing pay-per-view nights, and we put that into the first all-female UK fight night because we know that those characters deserve it and are there to be grown. So I think if you look at the parity we bring to it every day, but also those moments that we manage to elevate, I think you can see that the love and care is there from every single person that works on them.
Well, Jo, I have really enjoyed the last hour or so chatting with you. I know we've raised some pretty big questions, and when we have those answers, we'll make sure we do the next podcast from all three of our private islands.
Like a cut, please. It's on record now, so I want my cut.
Don't you worry. Well, thank you very much for your time. We really do appreciate it, and look forward to charting the journey over the next few months and years. As you said, I think it's an exciting and certainly an inspiring one working in the industry.
Yeah, onwards and upwards. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much.